Good morning, and thank you for joining me on another episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. I am your host, Sharifa Hardy, and I have an amazing, amazing, amazing show for you today. And one of the reasons that I know is so amazing is because I have new guests and return guests. And based on the conversation we had previously, especially from our returning guests, I know we're going to have an amazing time, but I get to learn more about our new guests, and so do you. And so before I introduce my first guest, I'm going to ask you to do what I always ask you to do, and that is to go ahead and share this show. That's right. You want to go ahead and share it on all your social media. You want to text a friend, tweet a friend, inbox a friend, and let them know that the Roundtable Talk Show is live, because friends don't let friends miss out on the Roundtable Talk Show. I'm going to introduce my first guest. I'm so excited about speaking with this gentleman because I love learning history. I want to say good morning to Thomas Lofton, who helped bring in lowriders. Good morning, Thomas. How are you?
I'm great. And yourself?
I'm excited. So tell us about lowriders. Like, what is that even about? Now, let me just say this before I start. I'm in Long Beach, California, grew up on 74th in Vermont, which is right off of Florence in Normandy, right? I know what I'm talking about. But right. Hey, tell us a little bit about your journey.
Well, I grew up in the culture. I grew up on Rosecrans and Central. And, you know, everybody I knew had a lowrider. And if they didn't have one, they wanted one. That was just the culture. You know, everybody, they didn't have Honda Civics back then and Toyota Corollas and Camrys, you know, so everybody could only afford like 64 Chevy Impalas and cars like that. So we got to work with what we had. So I learned from some gentlemen in the neighborhood how to work on them, how to build them. And one of them told me that if I learned how to continue to work on those, I'd never be broke. So I took that pathway and sat in my mother's backyard, bringing in some great money, you know. So years later, I was the one who pioneered it and told everybody, look, we got to come out of the backyard. We got rappers now. These guys they can put our cars in their videos. So when our famous rapper guys, you know, which they weren't famous back then, they started traveling the globe, and they would always call me and say, people want to buy that car from you. You know, I'm in Japan. This guy wants to buy that car. I'm in Germany and they want to buy your car. I'm in Australia. They want to know how much for your car or a car like that one. So before I know it, I started shipping cars all around the world. And then I started shipping car parts around the world. Before I know it, I thought that everybody had lowriders, but I found out it wasn't just us. I mean, we were the only ones with those lowriders, so that opened up the door for a huge multi-billion dollar market. So now there was like 3,000 cars probably roundabout in Compton, LA, and Watts back then. Now there's over 10 million lowriders worldwide, and we got cars in movies, TV shows, commercials, everything. Wherever you are, if somebody wants to use a car, a lowrider, to promote their business. So I was the one who kind of like really branded it and made it a mainstream business, and went back and helped a lot of people to monetize that business.
Wow. I didn't even have any idea that it really became a mainstream business. What I knew is that it was more of a movement. I mean, that's one of the things that we did in high school or back in the day. You hung out on Crenshaw in your lowrider, and you went up and down the strip. Like, these are just memories. But I didn't realize that I understand that people buy them, but that it went into mainstream, you know,
right,
America.
Well, you got, you know, I remember sitting down with film producers and cutting 5 movie deals and, you know, I'm negotiating with a video with artists and rappers. Well, okay, well, I want you to put a lowrider in every movie or every video. And, you know, we want 13 cars in this video and we want them to do this. And I would be that guy that had to figure all that out, who had convertibles. You know, San Diego Zoo wanted some lowriders in their commercial. You know, okay, well, who's going to bring the car down there? Who has that kind of car? And, you know, it became a real big business. So as far as it rolled into manufacturing, you know, so I currently manufacture car parts and ship them globally. You know, it's just a huge industry, and it's kind of fun because when someone tells you, wow, nope, I've never seen that car before. I would love to have one of those. Or I'm from Australia and I can't find that part. Can you send me one to Australia? And I'll be like, okay, the part is, you know, $50, but the shipping is $300, you know, and people pay this every day. So it's just an amazing opportunity to create successful people, you know. I was able to help over 100 people start businesses all the way from paint shops to transmission shops, you know, custom car shops, engine shops, muffler shops, interior shops, everything of revolving around automotive. We also have a huge industry of tow truck companies who go from coast to coast. I'll have people call me and say, I have 15 of those cars over here in South Carolina. I'm in Sumter, South Carolina. I have a farm and I got 15 in my backyard and I want to sell them to you for $300 per car. So I would pay $1,000 each to get them back to Compton, you know? So that opened the door for us to start buying tow trucks. And before I know it, we got like 15 to 20 tow trucks and I never see my friends anymore. You know, like they're always on the road towing cars. It's like, wow, he dropped those cars off at 3 a.m. and I don't get to see him no more. He's back. He's gone to Tennessee now. You know, somebody's selling us a whole ranch, or what do you call it? A whole junkyard is closing. And he has 365, 61s and 62s. So it was just a phenomenal ride. And now I get to travel the world and teaching people about it and what I've done, you know, who'd have ever known. And I also wrote a book. But the most important part was no one really wanted a lowrider shop next door to them in the commercial shopping centers that we were in. So it opened the door for us to create some real estate investments and start buying commercial real estate. So now, years later, people forgot about the whole car thing. And now they say, come tell us about real estate. You said you owned a commercial building. You said you built a house before. Come tell us about that. So now people are saying, oh, I didn't know TJ knows how to work on cars. You know, I thought he's the real estate guy. So I wrote a book called Monetizing Gentrification. Because during my travels, I noticed a lot of you know, people losing their houses and they've taken people's houses, selling them at tax liens. And I just see things that most people don't even comprehend, you know, like this big mass movement of people leaving California. There was over 700,000 people that left California in 2019. And now they're moving to the South and the amount of development in the South is just unprecedented. You know, I was with one home builder. And he said, yeah, we built 7,700 homes here and they're still building. And then the other guy said, yeah, we're the 10th largest builder here in South Carolina in Columbia. And I'm like, the 10th largest? Like, how many new houses have y'all built? So they're probably at 40,000 houses. So that's just that one area. Then you got Georgia, you got North Carolina, you got Louisiana. So it's just some phenomenal things are happening. And I'm the one who are best. The expert that can explain it to people, how do they monetize this situation? That's just a little bit of what I do.
Wow.
That seems like a lot if you ask me, but I do love the journey aspect of it, how you started one place and then you went somewhere else and now you're doing a completely different thing, because people tend Absolutely. To forget about the journey. You know, I do speaking engagements, I host 3 different talk shows. But right. And then when I'll mention designing a website, people are like, you know how to design a website? I'm like, all this started because I designed a website in 1994. And people were like, design mine. And then I started marketing. And then people were like, market for me. So it's always the beginning that people tend to forget. Now, I have more questions for you, but I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest so we can really get going and start the conversation. I want to go ahead and introduce Clisber Alvarez, who this was very interesting to me, but she is a certified mindset expert. Good morning, Clisber. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me. How's it going?
It's going wonderful. You are so welcome. I'm excited to have you here. And then sometimes I want to play this little game, right? I play it because I think I'm still a kid who won't grow up. But I will say, I spy with my little eye. And right now I see your believe in your dreams, you know, your smile, your energy, but I see your message, believe in your dreams. Is that something you live by?
Yes. And it's funny you say that, because today I was actually having my morning walk, and I did a little live. And it was something that I actually was talking about in my morning walks. I actually like to go on and do lives. And that was my message of the day. believing in your dreams, because a lot of people fear, you know, we have fears. We all have, you know, like everyone, we're human, you know, we all have internal fears. And this is my story. Basically, I came from New Jersey, and I have bipolar disorder, and I was diagnosed at the age of 16, and it was a struggle for me. You know, I feared everything. I feared you know, leaving my house, because I was living with my mom at the time. I was, when I was diagnosed at the age of 16, I mean, it was just I felt like the world, you know, just ended for me. And it got to the point where, it got to the point where, you know, I thought this was going to be a very hard situation where, you know, it was just going to be to the point where, you know, I fell into deep depression. I fell into depression. I fell into, a manic episode, and I was in high school, my grades dropped. I dropped out of high school, you know, but eventually I ended up, you know, seeing things in a different light. You know, I ended up going to a doctor who put me on medication, and, you know, I felt, I was like, you know what, I was very thankful for doctors, you know, for psychiatrists and for psychology, because eventually after I was put on medication, they told me, you know, at first I was really hesitant to take medication, because I felt like I was dependent on medication. I was dependent on something else that wasn't, you know, I never took medication. And for me, medication, it did a lot of negatives at first. You know, I gained a lot of weight and I was bullied in high school. I was to the point where it was, it did a lot of negative things for me at first. But when I actually started to see the positive things it did for me, you know, for my mental health, it was big. It was big, you know. I didn't take it seriously until I had my son. When I had my son, it was something that I had to make a choice. You know, for me, it's a little bit hard to, I don't know if you noticed, but it's a little bit hard to talk about those times because,
Well, you know what, Clisper, I appreciate you being honest. I appreciate you being real. And yes. When I watch you speak, what I see and what I feel is the raw emotion in your face. You're reliving it right now. Like it was today. It was yesterday. Mm-hmm. And what I want to do, so I'm you know, I'm going to do something that I typically don't do. But before going on to our next guest, I want to, about what she does, I want to introduce her. Because I know there's something that she wants to say. So our next guest is Dr. Jody DeLuca of Erie Counseling. Jody, I saw, maybe I'm reading it wrong, but I saw the concern on your face. Okay, wait, I just have to unmute you first, Jody. Can we get you unmuted? I'm like having, can we unmute you, Jody?
Okay. I
send her a hug, Jody. Yes, send her a hug.
You know, for me, what you represent is a superhero. That, you know, Clisper, you're a superhero. Your kryptonite is the bipolar. Bipolar is by far one of the most challenging psychological vulnerabilities for the individual, but also the family. And you're magnificent. In my world, you are magnificent because the challenges sometimes are seamless. And what I hear is you didn't give up. Yeah, the medications, especially when they're first trying to find the right cocktail, can be devastating, but good for you. And also, you know, you can see the emotion as you go back in time when you, at 16, that's a very vulnerable age for anybody.
Yeah.
But at 16, being diagnosed with the bipolar, is shattering for so many.
Yeah.
And when you were talking about it, I could actually see that you're back in that time. And that's the mm-hmm. unique thing about being human, is we can experience the past and the future and the present, and viscerally, physiologically, you're back there. So I want to say, wow, I'm impressed. I know every day is a challenge for you.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. just the fact that you're able to talk about it, and like Sharifa was saying, the rawness, the honesty, that's what validates the same experience with so many, because there's so many people living with bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And you're a testament that, hey, you can get through it. And your sign, that's hope. Believe in your dreams. Never give up. And we also know a high level of individuals that go on to change the world and that are creative. And intellectual giants have mm-hmm. bipolar disorder. It seems to be the way the brain works a lot, is there's like disparities. Mm-hmm. And but we also know the greatest artists, sculptors, and again, creative individuals have bipolar disorder. So I want to thank you for sharing that. For me,
as a
clinical psychologist, you're it. So thank you.
Thank you, seriously. And honestly, like, with, you know, that was seriously, it was something that I, it was a goal of mine at the time. You know, I had this blog where I started, and it actually, you know, I remember in these phases where I had the manic episodes, I remember I wanted to reach people. I wanted to reach people who were also struggling, you know, with my words. I wanted to reach them and actually help them, you know, help them through their struggle. And I didn't know how at the time. And now that I look back and I'm like, you know, and I've actually did the Good Housekeeping magazine feature and WebMD and all these things. And I'm like, you know what? I've accomplished something, you know, and it feels good, because it's like, you know what? Now I can actually say to someone and say to them, you know what? You can also do it. You are also worthy.
Okay, Clisper, you know? I just wanted to ask you, you mentioned the article, but we haven't introduced that. So tell us about that. I mean, that's a huge accomplishment. We want to learn more about it. So you wrote an article, or you wrote about your story. So what happened?
Well, I actually, I've always liked writing. I've always liked, writing. My favorite subject in school was English. And so I've always wanted to be a writer, and I don't know, I just right place, right time, and Good Housekeeping magazine, they picked up my article, and so it's in the May print issue. Also webmd.com has an article on me, and it's called, if I'm not mistaken, it's the one on Good Housekeeping is I Am Not My Mental Health. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
I think that's beautiful. That's beautiful. I have more questions for you, but I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest. And our next guest has also been here on the show before. I believe this is her third appearance, and each time we learn so much. So I want to introduce Deb Gordon. And Deb Gordon is going to talk to us about Healthcare Consumers Manifesto, her new book. Good morning, Deb. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? Oh, thank you for having me back. Thanks for the boost. I appreciate it.
You are so welcome. It's always a pleasure to have you here. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to go ahead and introduce you after Jody and after Clisver is because we're going to bring Thomas back in. I think Thomas fell asleep on us. I don't know. But one of the things that you ladies have in common is Clisver has a medical situation. Jody works with, you know, in counseling. But one of the things that people with mental health run into, or one of the problems they run into, is insurance coverage, right? They have issues. They know they have issues. They have some, they want to speak to someone, but without insurance, they may not have that option. So Deb, talk to us a little bit about that, as well as who you are and what you do.
Sure, thank you. So I'll start at the end. So I was a former health insurance executive. I was the head of marketing for a health plan that helped low and moderate income people get access to healthcare coverage. And I, after many years, I realized that so many people, because of my background, would come to me and say, like, what should I do? And, you know, when it came to their healthcare or their health insurance situation, or my dad's going on Medicare, what plan should he pick? Or I'm switching jobs. Is my new insurance as good as my old insurance? I have no idea. How could I possibly know? But the questions, you know, it's so hard. Everyone's situation is different, and there are so many details to sort of grapple with. I felt like I'm completely the wrong person to answer those questions. But I realized through those questions that people have almost nowhere to go for answers. And if I can't, after almost a decade in the health insurance industry and longer in healthcare in general, if I don't know how to help them, like, what chance does anyone have of figuring out their healthcare situation? So that really set me on the path to try to understand the consumer's journey, like the just regular people. What do we experience as Americans or people living in the US when we need healthcare? So hence the Healthcare Consumers Manifesto. Through real people stories, I talk about sort of why is healthcare so complicated and what can individuals do to get a better handle on their own needs and decisions. I feel like there was another part of your question. I used up the whole time just on myself.
No, it's beautiful. It's wonderful. That was the part about you and what you do. So the initial question is, number one, was the, you know, specifically we were discussing mental health.
Thank you. So this is a topic that is really important for so many reasons. I wrote a whole chapter about it. I really felt like that chapter was, I say sometimes, like, I know you're supposed to love, like your children, you're supposed to love all the chapters the same. But one of my favorites to research and write was the mental health chapter, because I learned so much. I interviewed a dozen therapists and mental health providers and consumers who access those services. And, you know, what I learned that, first of all, what I already knew, and everyone, you know, we all already know in the healthcare industry, how important mental health care is to people, to their overall health and well-being. You know, health insurers pay a ton of money for medical care for people with mental health diagnoses who can't access care. So why don't they also pay, you know, why don't they make it easier to get that mental health care that they need? We know it costs more. We know it's bad for people. It's bad for the system when people can't get what they need. But the problems or the barriers are so layered. So I did hear a lot of complaints about insurance from mental health providers, that insurance companies make their jobs really difficult. They don't always know even what they're going to get paid, and whatever it is, what the provider's going to get paid, whatever it is a lot less than they feel is fair. And so a lot of mental health care providers opt out of insurance altogether. That creates a cycle where if you're a consumer and you need help, mental health care, you can very often struggle to find someone who will take your insurance. Mm-hmm. And then even if you do, how many visits? I just read an article, met another author who said she thought her therapy visits were covered, only to find out that was just the first three visits. Now she needs therapy. She goes to therapy once a month, but only 3 months worth was covered with still with a copayment. So, you know, I think we have just a really broken approach to mental health care. You know, a 20%, a fifth of Americans, American adults will have any mental health care need at, you know, in any given year. This is not like a rare disease. One in five of us, and that doesn't mean in our lifetimes, like more in our lifetimes, will have some need for mental health care. So why do we make it so hard to get the services we need?
I'm going to come back to you, Deb, but I want to pop over to Jody real quick and ask her. Maybe that's a question Jody might have some assistance with. Jody, what do you think? What do you see at your council session center?
Well, and this is all, everything, like Deb was saying, it's always been difficult for individuals to get help for mental health, whether it be through insurance or self-pay. But now with this pandemic, it's even more so. First of all, there's not enough of us as licensed clinicians to be able to accommodate everybody. The calls that come in every day have doubled, and in some time, and some at some periods, or it depends how the numbers spike with the virus. Let me backtrack. I see, and my colleagues see, an increase in phone calls and needs as the numbers go up, and then a decrease as the numbers go down with the virus. One of the main concerns is that not everybody can afford the services. There's not a lot of, let's say, companies or organizations that will do pro bono work or will cover a lot of people. And then a lot of times, the insurance makes it very difficult for individuals to even get coverage. The number one question from people who are insured is, hey, do you take my insurance? Not every provider takes every insurance. And like Deb was saying, a lot of therapists today, because the insurance companies do make it very difficult for us as clinicians, a lot of times they dictate what we can do and how long we can see the individual. You know, it's a very distressing situation. And then on top of it, you realize that it's the unknown. We don't really know what's going to happen. And I've done several interviews where I've stated, we are just at the beginning of the mental health crisis with this pandemic. The aftermath, the post-traumatic stress is going to be incredible. And there's going to be a higher demand for us. But like Deb was saying, the way the system is set up, it doesn't work necessarily in the best interest of the person who wants to get some counseling. And sometimes it's just like, hey, the person needs to be validated. All these things are going on. I lost my job. I can't feed my family. If I'm home with the kids one more day, I'm going to lose it. All of that. This is a time when mental health and the provisions of mental health around the globe, but for the United States, is a priority. It's a collective priority right now, but you will not find that the system is helping as much as it probably should.
Can I share something too? Another thing that I've seen is the lack of translation too. For example, in certain hospitals, certain languages, for example, they don't have the proper help with like certain different languages. Mm-hmm. And the lack of that, they don't have certain people, like they don't have the proper help because of that, you know, and they stay in the hospital longer. They stay in the hospital, they don't get the proper attention pretty much. Because of that, and that also does not help the situation. And I feel like I've seen that too.
From the medical end or the behavioral health end?
In the mental, I can say in both, you know, okay. But I've seen it in the mental health unit more, like, okay. Because, you know, they don't get the proper help. Like, you know, I went one time to get my appointment, like an outpatient appointment, and I saw someone, and I speak Spanish, so they actually had me translating for a patient, and I'm, you know, if I'm a patient, I can't translate for the other patient.
Okay.
You know, and I feel like that was inappropriate.
Most hospitals have a translator or have a group of translators on staff, but also have a remote translator that they are able to access. But I think, again, healthcare, the infrastructure, the staffing, and the accommodation and the representation is limited.
Yeah, you know? I think, go ahead, Deb.
I was just going to say that actually with COVID, it's counterintuitive, but a lot of healthcare providers, hospitals, and doctors' offices are really struggling financially because while, you know, everyone is worried about COVID and a lot of people need urgent or emergency care or inpatient care for COVID, everything else shut down. So all the elective, all the non-urgent, even if it's not elective, if it's not, you know, life and death, a lot of that healthcare didn't happen. And so a lot of healthcare providers have gone without as much reimbursement or revenue as they usually get. And there's, I think, data coming out, but there has been some evidence of layoffs within healthcare. And there's certainly, you know, a hospital cannot lay off an emergency room doctor or nurse or, you know, a staff person, but they sure could. I'm not saying they are cutting back on translators, but the support staff or staff in other parts of the hospital could well be hit by actually economic hardship.
I think as a globe, as a, you know, a people, as the entire world, we've been hit with economic hardship. So I want to speak to Thomas. Thomas, you still with us? You're chilling, listening to the ladies, getting ready for some more conversation. But I think when we go through something and we have hardships, the one question that we ask is, how do we get more? You know, how do we obtain more? So have you seen more people have questions about real estate and how they can have, you know, diversify their portfolio?
Yes. You know, the real estate market is booming. Corona is not affecting it at all. You know, it's construction. I was just asking yesterday, I did a Facebook Live and I'm like, wow, we don't have any money to help the schools, but we got plenty of money for new sidewalks, new construction, new streets and areas. They fixing potholes in certain places. It's like, okay, what's really going on here? You know,
I noticed that too. But also one of the questions that I had, not to cut you off, but I tend to cut people off because I got to jump in there and get that question in. I've heard, you know, and I'm listening to you, but I've heard varying responses to that. I've had people who said, you know, definitely do not focus on real estate. Do not buy. People are walking away from homes by the millions. They're leaving them because, you know, like you said, they're leaving California. They're leaving all these places and they're just leaving their properties behind. Then I had another guest who stands out to me, and I'm just saying he happened to be in Las Vegas, but he was just like, buy it now, buy everything. You can get it for pennies on the dollar. This is the perfect time to buy. So I was just kind of interested.
Well, you know, I'm a real estate investor. That's why I do a lot of coachings and trainings, because, you know, in certain situations, it's kind of like an investor is like a firefighter. You know, when everybody else is running out the burning building, the investors are running in saying, hey, I'll buy that burnt up house from you. Or, hey, you know, so that's the same thing with Corona. You know, we've gotten to a situation where we have to be careful because there are fake false flag alarms that's going on, telling people that things are bigger than what they seem. So you should sell your house. Mm-hmm. You know, the hardest hit area is, I'm looking at my map, right? I have a little map with gentrification. I'm like, okay, these are the hard hit gentrification areas. They really want people out of these areas because they're close to the beach, they're close to the jobs, they're close to everything that people want. So guess what? These are the areas that they're really going after for gentrification. So all of a sudden, I look up and they say, oh, all of these same areas, they're all opportunity zones now. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, well, people are like, nope, not selling, still ain't selling, we ain't going nowhere. Yeah. Then all of a sudden this new thing happens, coronavirus. Guess what? Hardest hit areas is the same areas. Boom. These areas are hard hit. So it's like there's always something negative happening into those areas where the real estate is the most valuable. So when they say, oh, people are selling houses, I'm like, my research doesn't say nothing's being sold. They're all in the news like, yeah, everybody's selling, the market's about to crash. And I'm like, that's not what my research says, because I'm like flying around like the vultures, the eagles are looking, waiting to snatch something up. And it's like, okay, we're starving out here. There's nothing to eat because nobody's dumping houses like the news is telling me. So it becomes subliminal. It's stressful, like you guys say. It's becoming very stressful. Should I sell my house? The news tells me to sell because everybody, the news said everybody's dumping, but I don't see for sale signs in front of my house down the street, around the corner. You know, now you got TJ traveling across the country telling us to not sell. He's giving classes saying that people are investing. In fact, learn how to build and all of that. And people are just stressing people out. Like, who do I believe? The media says it, then there's this guy named TJ. I don't know, you know? So let me buy his book. It makes sense. Disaster economics. Okay. Could this be a ploy to get the real estate?
Well, that's interesting. You just threw out a term, disaster economic. I love it. I think that's great. Yeah. But I want to go over, I'm going to come back, but I want to go over to Jody real quick, because it was something key that Thomas mentioned in that whole, I don't know who to believe. I don't know what to believe. And that is stressful. Should we wear a face mask? Should we not wear a face mask? California just closed down again on Monday. You know, everybody's like, oh, we're coming back. We're going back to normal. We can get out of our house. Shut completely back down. And so what can people do not to be so stressed out and not to be so confused about what's going on in the media, Jody?
Well, and that's an excellent question. And what TJ said, there's a lot of gentrification issues with real estate, by the way, going on here in Colorado, in Denver. And it's created a lot of anxiety, a lot of stress, a lot of depression. And that's a very real thing. And it goes to what you were saying, people don't know what to do. So what are the big issues? When is this going to be over? Will life ever be the same? Do we send our kids to school? Mask, no mask. You know, the human clinical trials with the vaccines are looking good, but who's going to get the vaccine? Who's going to make the vaccine? Who wants the vaccine? Who doesn't? And then we've got the whole election coming up in less than 100 days now. People, the frustration levels are so high that even no matter how hard many people try to keep things okay, there's still, like TJ was saying, there's that subliminal, there's that unconscious voice that's processing 24/7. Pay attention to your dreams, folks, is what I say, that there's that anxiety and that depression. So what do we do? And I tell people, we can only handle a little bit at a time. Whatever the priority, whatever the issue in front of you for that moment is what you have to address. You have to reach out. But if we look at the whole picture of things, we start spinning and then we get very, very anxious because that puts us into a fight and flight mode. The mask thing is a real, real issue. And like I think I mentioned on a previous show, it's causing a lot of frustration. There's a lot of aggression. There's a lot of violence. To mask or not mask, science versus somebody's rights or what people feel emotionally. At the end of the day, the individual has to do what they feel is most comfortable for them. It creates so much anxiety that people are actually seeking help, not only from us as licensed therapists, but also from physicians for medications for now, not necessarily forever, because they can't sleep, they can't eat. Many people are becoming agoraphobic, afraid to leave the home. And at the end of the day, oh, very much so. At the end of the day, I tell them, we got to break it down. What are the number one triggers? So what I would suggest to people is make a list of the top five triggers, stressors that make you spin, make you anxious, break them down. And what are the problem resolutions? What are the possible solutions? What are the pros and the cons? And sometimes that takes weeks, but we can only take so much at a time. And we've got so much coming on in the past, 4 months now? So much for so many people, so many issues that we're all in a fight and flight, all in a defense mode.
Yeah. I know because one of the things that you mentioned when referring to the mask, I've seen some of these videos where people try to go into the store, you know, and fight their way into the store as opposed to wearing a mask. It's like, okay, just wear the mask already. It's one of those things that I never thought would come down to your belief or your belief system or your personal rights. It's like, to me, I just feel like whether you believe it or not, it's is respect. You know what I mean? It's a respect thing because you're showing respect for the people, the other people who are in the stores and the other people who work in the stores to simply just put on the mask. But then you have other people who have a completely different argument about that. But I wanted to go over to Deb real quick. One of the things, and we spoke to Jody about the mental health aspect of what's going on in the world, but with, again, let's go back to one of the things that's adding stress to that is people don't have anywhere to go for help. I had a friend of mine who was gainfully employed. She was working for a large corporation, wound up getting laid off as a direct result of COVID. And one of the things that happened to her that she didn't even realize was she wouldn't be able to keep the same type of healthcare. And she has bad asthma, you know, had an asthma attack, you know, because she's not even thinking about her insurance. She had a bad asthma attack, goes to the hospital, you know, she no longer has insurance. I'm sure you run into that, Deb.
Yeah, and so many millions of people are in that same boat. There was just an article in the New York Times about, I think, about 5 million people are now without insurance because of COVID. That number, it's probably going to go up because something like 20 million people, 18 million. The last time I looked, it was like 18 million people were on continuing unemployment claims. So we've had tens of millions of people file for unemployment. And a lot of those folks are staying unemployed, you know, while the economy is not recovered. And who knows how long this condition is going to last. So I do get this all the time. You know, here's what I run down the list. Your friend, you know, maybe the first thing you can look at is COBRA. So if you have had insurance, and you have healthcare needs and you need to be able to access specific doctors or hospitals, COBRA is one option. It's very expensive. And so when you've lost your job and your source of income, it's not the best time to suddenly pay full price for your health insurance without any help from the employer. On the other hand, it's an option if you are if you have the means and you're in dire straits. That's one. Most people can't afford it. And for most people, it's not really worth the money anyway. So I always send people to the state or federal health insurance exchange. So some states, I live in Massachusetts, we opened up special enrollment period. So folks who were impacted by COVID could get covered. But even in places where that's not the case, if you have a change in your insurance, so you've lost your job and that's how you got health insurance, that counts as a qualifying event. So you can apply to enroll through one of the marketplaces. That's the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Same deal. If you have no income, you can try to apply for Medicaid. A lot of folks don't want to be on a public, subsidized health insurance. And I'm like, why on earth not? You know, it's very robust coverage. It's free or low cost. It's hard to qualify. So and depending on where you live, it can be easier or harder because some states expanded who can get onto Medicaid. But if you can get it, because you do not want to be without insurance during a pandemic. And then finally, I encourage people, you know, if you're out of luck, you're out of options, you still need healthcare, you know, take a consumer mentality to it. Before you get healthcare, ask how much something's going to cost you and try to negotiate. Even if most people don't love to negotiate, it's not our culture here in the States, but, you know, to at least put your financial situation on the table. There's absolutely no shame in not having the means to pay, you know, a grotesque hospital bill. So yes, see if there's an option and then try to negotiate it down or get a payment plan.
Absolutely. One of the things that you mentioned was a consumer mindset. And that stood out to me because I believe in the last show, we actually discussed that in more detail. And with the consumer mindset, we asked the price about a lot of different things. You know, I think we discussed the example of, you know, I wouldn't go buy an airline ticket and just get on the airline and then arrive at my destination only for them to tell me that airline ticket was $20,000. You know, we know the cost of the airline ticket before we even leave the ground, before we get to the airline. But I think a lot of people have that shame about asking, but I also think it was created for people to believe that they do not have the right nor the ability to even ask. One of the things that I think as a people we do with no other industry is with doctors. If this is what the doctor says, or this is what we have to do, we just do it. We don't question it, you know, we just do it. But with a consumer mindset, let's talk a little bit about some of the options we have with a consumer mindset when we go into the doctor.
And, you know, I think doctors, nurses, other healthcare providers are not usually trained to talk about cost. Some of them have actually been trained not to talk or think about cost, you know, that the right thing to do is only look at the health or the medical situation. But in fact, how can you get the care you need if you can't afford it? And so I think we tend to be shy about talking about money in general, and especially with an authority figure. I'm not sure why, you know, why are we so, you know, there's, like I said, I just think there's like no shame, but still maybe we don't want to offend the doctor by asking questions, or we don't want to admit that we're worried about money or how to pay. I just think that one of the things about COVID, it has been, I'd say a really unfortunate, rude way to get here, but it does make a lot more people more sensitive to financial issues. And so let's use that for good and put it on the table. So I do believe that doctors want their patients to get the best care. And I don't think that the average doctor is offended if you ask about the cost. They may not know the answer, and that's okay. You can be forgiving of their, you know, that's just not what they're trained in. But if you say, hey, doc, I really want to follow your recommendations, but I'm a little worried. I am worried about what it's going to cost me. Can we look into what that is, or if there are options? I've never met a doctor who I think would object to that conversation. They may say, I don't have time for that right now. Let's follow up. Or I'm not the right person. Let me bring in my colleague, nurse, social worker, administrator who can help. But I think it shouldn't take so much courage, but if it does, you know, we have to find the courage to say, I need to talk to you about the cost of this plan. I want to follow it. I'm not sure I'll be able to. They will want to help. I really believe that.
I believe that too. I think that we just have, you know, my thing right now, my favorite phrase is we have to start the conversation. You know, we have to start the conversation and letting people know that you have the ability to ask, because I'm a conspiracy theorist. I think it's a whole conspiracy with the insurance company, so they don't want you to know, because then they don't get paid, you know. So I think we have to let more people know, because I think I mentioned on the first show you was on, I went to the doctor one time and I was there for hours. And I had really bad back pain. I didn't know what was happening. But when I finally saw the doctor at the ER over the weekend, he told me to take 2 aspirins, basically, and then call my doctor in the morning, you know, Monday morning. And so I did, got everything taken care of. But then a week later, I got a bill for $2,500. And I was like, okay, you charged me $2,500 for aspirin? Like, that's literally what I felt like. I was like, what kind of magic aspirin is this? It better cure everything. You know what I mean? I needed to cure cancer for $2,500. Thomas?
You know, that's interesting. We're having this conversation about the healthcare. As a consultant and a coach, I know that when a person says, oh, mom's sick, you know, she's got cancer, we're about to lose mom. I'm like, okay, take mom's house out of her name, you know, because she doesn't want to go into the doctor's office and not have insurance, but has a house worth $500,000. That's paid for, because nobody talks about how many houses that have been leaned through the hospitals. How many doctors have taken people's houses because they've ran up an excessive doctor's bill. And that's the first thing they do. They ask you, do you own a home? Because we can attach our name to that home. So I talk about this all the time. And this is a conversation that never makes it to the media. It never is not public common knowledge. You know, people don't realize, they just go walking into the hospital and then all of a sudden they say, oh, you have terminal cancer, and they're like, oh my God, oh my God. And they're like, I got to fix this, I got to fix that. I'm like, no, you need to take that house out your name first. You know, deed that over to your children now, because you won't have any generational wealth to leave them. You know, I've seen them put people on life support that they should have just let go, you know, and they're like, no, we can keep them alive at a cost of $50,000 a day, you know. And then all of a sudden, when that money runs out, it's like, okay, the house is worth $800. We've ran up $900 worth of bills. Maybe we need to let her go. And I'd be like, most people don't look at it like that. They don't want to look at it like that. They choose to be quiet. They're like, well, we're talking about mama, so we don't want to talk about money. We can't put a value on mama's life. I'm like, actually, you know, we don't want to, mama don't want to stay around long enough to send everybody into poverty now. If she's 99 years old, she knows her time is coming. We should not be trying to keep her alive at $50,000 a day when she's sitting here. I mean, don't look at me bad, y'all. I'm just...
We're not looking at you bad at all, because I can tell you that I can relate and I can understand, and I've never had this conversation. I've never had this conversation at all. I've never heard it explained like that at all. You know, so you definitely have to come back, because I want to continue this conversation. But I think it's because of the spin, right? I think what happens is people talk about and they discuss the high cost of healthcare. They discuss the damage that can be done when somebody is terminally ill. They discuss the $50,000 a day bill to keep mama alive. But the aspect that you're saying is, okay, in the process of this, these are the things that are lost while the person is being kept alive. So you're saying, okay, we don't want to put a price on mama's life, but to a certain extent, what you're saying is the doctors are. Or the hospitals are, not specifically the doctors.
Yes, yes.
Can I say one thing? So in support of Thomas here, you know, I think what you're really highlighting is the role of and importance of consumer choice. And that a lot of times in healthcare situations, we feel helpless. We feel like we have no choices. And sometimes that's true, but very often, you know, mama may actually, my mom's like, you keep me alive as long as possible, right? Like, and I interviewed a doctor who was like, oh, I want my last breath. Like, you take heroic measures. He was really funny about it. But like, that's legitimate. Do that if that's what the person wants. A lot of people given a choice will say, I would rather not burden my family. I want to factor right. the cost or the right. impact, the financial impact, like you said, Thomas, on the generational economic impact. That's important to me. That's a perfectly valid conversation. Should that drive all decisions? I don't think so. But should it be part of the conversation? Should it be a factor if that's the consumer's value and priority? It definitely, that consumer should have a voice and their values should be part of the decision.
And the conversation. Absolutely. I definitely agree. Now, I know, Thomas, you want to say something. So what I'm going to do is let me wrap up the show and you can say it in your closing statement. We are coming down to the last few minutes of the show. And what I love to do at the end of every show is just simply allow my guests the opportunity to speak directly to the audience, to everyone who is watching live, as well as everyone who's watching this show in the archives, and simply let them know what you want them to take away from your appearance. And we are going to start with you, Thomas.
Well, I want everyone to look into health, alternative medicines, you know, herbs, for example. You know, there are so many, all these vegetables and fruits on the planet, they're not just here for us to have fun with them. They're here for, they're the medicine. That's the real medicine. Long before there was a medical doctor or a Kaiser hospital, there was the herbs, you know, there was the trees that we got these vegetables off of, superfoods, you know. So we have to look at that, you know. A lot of it was explained, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Sebi was my coach.
And we gonna talk. I got so many questions about Dr. Sebi. So we hold on, we're gonna talk later. We're gonna talk and come back because we're gonna have a whole new conversation. I'm waiting for Nick to get that documentary out. That's what Nick needs to be focused on right now. But let me go ahead and hear from Jody. Jody, what do you have for us? I love me some Jody. Jody's amazing, except for she on mute right now. We're going to fix that. Jody! Okay, Okay, let's get you off.
Okay. These are difficult times, to say the least, and there's so much coming at every one of us. We need to be more tolerant. We need to be more patient with ourselves. We need to be more understanding of ourselves and tolerant of others as well. There is no easy fix. We don't know what tomorrow may bring, but what we can focus on is, what is the best that I can do today? What can I do to decrease whatever thoughts or feelings that are making me or those I love crazying? Be patient with yourself. Be patient with others. There has to be an end in sight, and always explore your options. There's always options, and never feel boxed in, because there's always somebody else, whether it be family, friends, or a professional, who can give you information that may change the whole picture. So that's my message. Reach out, be tolerant, be kind to yourself.
Beautiful. Jody DeLuca, Erie, Colorado Counseling. Elizabeth, you're welcome. What do you have for us, Elizabeth?
I just want to say that everything and every change is a choice, and that if we choose to be positive, we can accomplish everything we set our mind to, and that just choose positivity, I think.
Where can we see some of your writing?
I have some of my writing on, let's say, Good Housekeeping Magazine May print issue, webmd.com. I have Prosperity Life. I have some coming up on BP Magazine September issue. I have some in there's just so many.
We don't follow you.
You can see some of my stuff on bluegrayslifestyle.com.
Bluegrayslifestyle.com.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining us. We're going to watch Thank out you. For the name Clisver Alvarez, and I'll be sitting down watching television. I'll be like, hey, I know her. I see her. She was on my show. Definitely. So I applaud you. Thank you, Deb. What do you have for us?
I will just say, first of all, great group. Thank you for this really important conversation. And I think that a theme I heard from everyone, and I really believe, is that each of us has a voice. So it can be overwhelming right now, as Jody described, or, you know, talked about. And let's make something useful out of this really difficult time. Let's open new conversations. Let's put our needs and issues and priorities on the table. Let's be honest with ourselves and each other and use our voices.
I love it. That's why I always enjoy when you're on the show, Deb, when Jody comes and join us. I hope that Clisver and Thomas decide to come back and return to the show, because I gotta pick Thomas's brain. Every time I ask him a question, he's like, well, let me tell you about Dr. Sebi, let me tell you about real estate, let me tell you about I'm like, I had no idea from your bio, let me tell you about the fruits. So Thomas, Clisver, Jody, Deb, definitely want to come back. I appreciate you all for being here. I want to thank you for being a guest on today's episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. I especially want to thank everyone who tuned in to watch the show live, as well as everyone who is watching this show in the archives. I appreciate you. I appreciate your love. I appreciate your support. I was just watching all the hearts go up in the live. Just thank you. But I always ask, don't just watch the show. Don't just share the show. Please support our guests. Reach out to them. Contact them. Their information, their websites are in the post. And if you are interested in being a guest, please visit the website at asksharifa.com, because we want to hear about what you're doing, what you're up to, and we can share it with our audience. Until tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, everyone have a safe and a blessed day. Bye now.